Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in African Studies. I'm Jacob Ivey, one of the hosts of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Seth Markle about his new book, A Motorcycle on Hell Run, Tanzania, Black Power, and the Uncertain Future of Pan-Africanism, 1964 to 1974, just recently published by Michigan State University Press in 2017 as part of the Ruth Sims Hamilton African Diaspora series. Seth Markle is an associate professor of history and international studies at Trinity College. His new book attempts to convey both the character of modern nationhood in Tanzania, as well as the activists in the diaspora who shaped and were affected by it. Seth Markle, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem at all. Seth, could you tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to the field of African studies?
Sure. Being a historian, I'll probably be long-winded on this response because I really feel like it does go back to, when I was an undergraduate student. Studying Africana studies at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts. I was really introduced to African Americans kind of traveling to Africa within this context of Pan-Africanist struggle. I was exposed to that history even more when I studied abroad. Trinity College, where I teach, is a liberal arts college. And so I do want to tell this story just because of how kind of transformative that experience can be. So I was studying at the University of Ghana and just started doing research about African Americans who were there during the 1950s and 1960s when Kwame Nkrumah was the leader of Ghana. And Nkrumah was somebody who was a Pan-Africanist. He really advocated for African Americans and people from the Caribbean islands to come to Ghana during the 50s and 60s and participate in building, one of the first sub-Saharan African nation to gain its independence, to come build that nation. And so I was attracted to that and got exposed to scholarship by Kevin Gaines and others who are writing about it. But I was also exposed to African Americans living in Ghana in the late 90s at the time. And so I really started to pursue that question in that research for the past 20 years. And I really came to learn about Tanzania by following the works of Malcolm X, who I talk about in the first chapter of my book, kind of seeing what he was doing after he leaves the Nation of Islam in 1964, goes on this independent route and creates a secular organization called the Organization of Afro-American Unity. He's the one who really starts to bring Tanzania to the attention of African-Americans in particular. And so I start that story there. And it was really kind of researching Malcolm, his speeches and his writings, where he's kind of advocating or identifying a number of African nations like Algeria, Ghana, places that he's telling African Americans, like, these are the places you need to watch. These are the progressive, newly independent nations that you need to build alliance with. And so that's where my story starts, really, with the first chapter is Malcolm laid out this kind of groundwork. And how does this generation of African Americans and Caribbean intellectuals and activists who are identifying with really a kind of Pan-Africanist, Black nationalist approach to activism and connecting with Tanzania, how are they going about doing that by traveling to Tanzania and working to help build the Tanzanian nation?
Oh, indeed, indeed. And we'll talk about Malcolm X a bit later, because I do think it's probably one of the most fascinating chapters in the book. I have to ask, though, because I know our audience want to know, probably one of the most fantastic things that you have is the title, A Motorcycle on Hell Run. So you outline where this comes from right at the beginning of the book, but I'd like you to sort of ask, where did this title come from? And building upon that, why do you think, as you say, this sort of became the symbol of the search for a new conception of nationhood and belonging within Tanzania?
Sure. The title, again, kind of going through various iterations of creating a title. And this was actually a conversation I had with some people that were reviewing my work and kind of offering some really good critique, as well as a conversation I had with students. I teach a class roughly about the book, about kind of Pan-Africanism in the 20th century. And so really, in doing research, I identified this individual, Robert F. Williams. A lot of people don't know about him, but he was considered this rival to Martin Luther King. He worked for the NAACP, which is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a major civil rights group in the United States. But he was working down south. He was a former war veteran, and he started to advocate armed self-defense, which was something that a lot of people don't know was part of the movement, not just the nonviolence. There was actually a discussion within the movement around using armed self-defense as a strategy and tactic. And so Williams really advocated this, and as a result, He was identified and targeted by the United States government. He had to go into exile. He went into exile to Cuba, later China, and then he tries to get political refugee status in Tanzania. And while he's there, he goes on a motorcycle trip from Dar es Salaam, the coastal city, the kind of political capital at the time in Tanzania, and goes on this 1,300-mile journey to Zambia, which is a neighboring country of Tanzania. And he takes this road that's called or nicknamed Hell Run, because it's incredibly treacherous. It's kind of leads from the city into the rural. And he does this on a motorcycle. And he does it with two companions, an African-American expatriate and a Tanzanian mechanic. But then he comes back from Zambia by himself, and he writes about this journey, this adventure. And I think that really speaks to what African Americans were doing. They were coming to Tanzania. They're being very experimental with what they were trying to do as far as contribute to nation building in a way that was mutually beneficial to both the movement in the U.S. or Jamaica or Trinidad, as well as beneficial to the government in building and trying to create this kind of socialist nation. And so I just really was attracted to this idea of being on a motorcycle. It's kind of unsteady, going and kind of pursuing something that they've never done before, and not really knowing what the outcome or the journey would be like, and really talking about this idea of confronting modernity. I mean, there's a lot of studies, of course, about African independence after 1945 and the ways in which that African states and peoples were really trying to define themselves as these citizens, right? And really trying to create a new kind of Afro-modernity, if you will. And so I kind of felt like that trip encapsulated, Robert Williams' trip encapsulated what these African Americans and Caribbean intellectuals and activists were really trying to do in carving out this new kind of path in collaboration, in Pan-African collaboration with a one-party state and nationalist leaders.
Yeah, indeed. And I would be remiss to ask, when you were doing research, were you able to go along Hell Road and see what it was like?
Unfortunately, no. But I have gone on sort of, other sort of long road trips that kind of gave me this, really good idea about what Robert F. Williams and others were really trying to do, or how the trip, again, impacts the way they view the world. Because I think in a broader framework, this book is about, I'm interested in diaspora. I'm interested in diaspora identity and consciousness and the ways in which Tanzania in this case, which was kind of regarded as like this new homeland for African Americans and people who were descendants of the transatlantic slave trade. Here they are going back to Tanzania, seeing themselves as these citizens and trying to contribute constructively to what the government was trying to do. But when you look at it from a diaspora framework, you begin to ask questions about how the homeland is constructed. What are they trying to do in terms of uplifting the homeland? And then specifically, how is the homeland responding to these people coming over and saying, I'm part of this project. We can work together. I can help you out in building this nation. And so that's kind of the overall framework is what happens when diaspora really kind of approaches this question of returning home. What happens when you do that in the context of African decolonization, anti-imperialism? And so we do see a lot of nostalgia. Do see a lot of experimentation with projects, and you do see a lot of kind of challenges and setbacks that really make this project something that doesn't necessarily sustain itself over time. You know, it's very short lived.
Yeah, you definitely hammer those points home again and again. I think that's one of the big major strengths of the book. And related to that, and sort of related to the wider diaspora, I found probably one of the most fascinating elements was the personal connections, these personal encounters that are discussed in the book. I particularly enjoyed the idea of Malcolm X and A.M. Babu meeting in the lobby of the Shepherd and Hilton hotels in Cairo. I love this image in my mind. And I was wondering, what impact do you think meetings like these had on the emergence or the solidification of Pan-Africanism during this period?
Sure. You know, that story is a really great story. Because I think it illustrates that, you know, these connections, these collaborative projects couldn't happen without that personal connection, without a kind of friendship and people getting to know each other on a more, you know, intimate level. These things could have never happened. And then even when you bring in Babu, who was, again, for listeners, a Zanzibari Marxist, Pan-Africanist, who was part of the Tanzanian government, who was very radical. Him and Malcolm became like really close friends. They had a lot in common. And yeah, they met at an Organization of African Unity conference in Egypt. And the great thing was that, you know, Babu, it took a lot of people on the Tanzania side. That's why I consider, you know, this book something that kind of straddles African-American history, Caribbean history, Tanzanian history, because you can't really tell this story of what diaspora peoples were doing in Africa or in Tanzania without telling how these Tanzanians were facilitating it. You know, there are people that were, again, a part of these one party state institutions that were understood where African-Americans were coming from as far as their oppression in the United States, were really attracted to the idea of international solidarity, realized that the information that they were getting from the United States about the racial situation in the U.S. was not necessarily a full picture, was not necessarily the picture from African Americans, but something that was more crafted by the U.S. government and the press. And so these people really took an effort to say, like, okay, I want to get to know not only these African Americans, but really try to understand their point of view. Obviously, they didn't necessarily agree on race and race consciousness and things like that, but there were these points of connection. And so these people were really, really important. I call them bridges. They really helped facilitate these sort of projects and initiatives that African Americans and Caribbean peoples were trying to put in place on the ground in Tanzania. But on another level, they got to know each other, you know, at bars, at clubs, in their homes. You know, they really created these personal connections that for a lot of people last till today. And while unfortunately the story is kind of like this thing around a failed project, but to look at it as this failed project, I mean, anytime you're looking at Black-led social movements, you don't necessarily see a large sort of massive victory when you're fighting against imperialism, white supremacy, et cetera, et cetera. So while this 10-year sort of project didn't necessarily work out in the long term, these people were able to create bonds of friendship that lasted into the 80s, 90s, until the present day. And I think that's important as well. You know, can't lose sight of the fact that this was a moment that facilitated kind of political development, facilitated people rethinking their identities as far as race, class, gender, culture. And that's the kind of, those are the small victories I think that people shouldn't lose sight of when they tackle this book.
Oh, yeah, and I would agree with that completely. And I think that it's something that even if you look at it from a pessimistic viewpoint, you know, there are celebrations that need to come out of this book that have to be made. Along those lines, though, there is this level of positivity in the relationships that are established across the diaspora. I was particularly struck when the Pan-African Congress and the ANC, the African National Congress of South Africa, lamented the death of Malcolm as sort of another Lumumba that had been killed because it's imperial projects. At the same time, though, that sort of leads to my next question. There seems to be a lot of difficulties and problems within these projects as well in creating these interconnections. And would you mind discussing a little bit with some of the major hurdles these leaders and organizations face during this period you're talking about?
Sure. You know, the Pan-African movement definitely sees this shift that happens after 1945 with the rise of independent nation states. Before, if you look at that movement, it was a lot of grassroots organizations and individuals from Africa, Caribbean, America, who were trying to work together around anti-colonialism, but they didn't necessarily have to deal with what independent state having now a role to play, even a leading role to play in the Pan-Africanist movement. What happens when that's a new factor or force that the diaspora has to contend with? Because when the state's involved, those relationships are not necessarily horizontal anymore. They're more vertical and hierarchical. So these African Americans and Caribbean intellectuals who didn't have state power now have to work with the one-party government, which has its own specific set of agenda, its own specific agenda, and then, you know, try to incorporate these people who want to be involved in whether it's book publishing or education, conference planning, whatever they're trying to do, whether as doctors, technical skills, people who are, you know, playing various roles in society. So they had to contend with that new power dynamic. And the state was very, I would say the Tanzanian government, Tanzanian state was very cautious in incorporating African Americans into these projects. They're saying you can do this, but you can only do it this way. So an example would be sort of freedom of political expression, you know, while in Tanzania, you know, critiquing allies of the Tanzanian government, particularly allies of the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, which had some rulers who were non-democratic rulers involved. But because of this alliance that Tanzania had, you know, there are certain restrictions that they placed on their activism. And that stuff kind of, those sort of tensions begin to play itself out over these various projects. I can think of in my second chapter, I talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was a major.
I was just about to ask you about that, because that seems to be one of those big questions of, you know, you have SNCC coming in and Stokely Carmichael and that division that exists between those two sides or that conflict that exists, I think is a perfect example of those problems that they may have.
Right. And really, you know, Stokely, you know, now, you know, he changed his name to Kwame Ture, but at the time known as Stokely Carmichael, although they had good intentions, of course, and they were trying to build this kind of alliance with Tanzanian government and party, its ruling party, you know, Carmichael was very, you know, he was in his mid-20s, you know, he had been catapulted to kind of being the national spokesman of the Black Power movement, kind of filling the void in leadership left after the assassination of Malcolm X. So he was someone who was very confident, you know, very arrogant in a way. And he came to Tanzania and just started to critique the African liberation movements, nation building, the direction of nation building in African countries, and just kind of went out of bounds. And that would have implications for what Strict was trying to do as far as create a program that would send African Americans with technical skills to Tanzania. That never actually ended up taking place until many years later, largely because of Stokely's impact on, or Stokely, because of Stokely's experience in Tanzania. From the government side, I mean, they had a big sort of meeting of the party when Stokely was there, but they assigned someone to kind of watch over him. They had to get word to him that he could no longer say certain things about certain governments. And so it was not necessarily this triumphant sort of experience where these relationships were solidified. That's why it's part of like an introductory chapter, because it was a process. It just didn't immediately happen like, hey, let's do something together on the Congo. It really took this relationship building to happen. And I don't want to say that Stokely and Snick at the time were building these relationships to not to the extent where the government fully trusted them in kind of carrying out some of their programs inside the country.
Oh, and I think it is an incredibly insightful chapter as you have these two emerging identities that are taking place in the 1960s and 1970s. And I think, again, it illustrates that fact that this is not a one nation story. This is not a one organization story as a whole. I wanted to ask, because he is probably one of the more important characters of this book. And that, of course, is Julius Nyerere, the first president of Tanzania. He's a powerhouse in African history, without a doubt. But what do you think your book adds to our understanding of this towering figure of African history?
Oh, that's a really great question. I don't think people knew the extent to which Nyerere was lauded in the African American, political community. I don't think they know to the extent to which that he kind of was the first, bridge, someone who didn't necessarily, explicitly spoke out against racial discrimination in the United States, and someone who explicitly invited African Americans to come to Tanzania. So that's one thing. I don't think people really knew that. But I also think too that he wasn't somebody that, he opened the door and he gave African-Americans in this diaspora a lot of leeway in a lot of ways too, kind of saying, we are allowing you to come. We are allowing you to set up projects and work with the government. I give you access to the government, giving you resources to do some of this stuff, particularly with the Six Pan-African Conference, which was organized largely by African-Americans from Washington, D.C. He gave them a place to live. He gave them travel money. So he did all these things that put in place this opportunity for this kind of experimental nation-building project to really play itself out. And I don't think that people really knew how accommodating he was. And it wasn't just in rhetoric. He was actually, making sure that he's actually targeting African Americans as a specific sort of group that could not only kind of promote Tanzania inside the United States, but also had the mindset, the loyalty to the project, to the socialist project, that he really thought could be infectious in a way by having them there and having their presence in the country. I also think that people kind of see Nyerere as somebody who was this sort of nonviolent, this kind of promoter of nonviolence. And when we get to the mid-60s to the 70s, here's somebody who's fully behind armed resistance and the liberation movements taking place in Central and Southern Africa. I think it's kind of like with Mandela. A lot of people don't know about the Mandela of the early 60s, the guy who was, reading about, guerrilla warfare and getting military training. Nyerere was someone, again, whose support behind the African liberation movements, again, I think is really underappreciated. But Nyerere was able to, again, facilitate these African Americans into that whole network. And that was incredibly important for them, because this was the first time for a lot of these people that I talk about who actually had access to state power. They're sitting there, they're meeting with government officials, they're meeting with Nyerere, they're meeting with major party leaders. And that was something that was very, very new and really exciting and a learning experience at the same time. So that's the way I think people should kind of see this person, very pragmatic. He's someone who was a visionary, but I think also understood that, post-colonial nation building was a gradual process. It wasn't immediate. You had to take sort of steps toward reaching this larger goal of in Nyerere's case, Ujamaa, socialism. And the fact that he saw African-Americans and people in the diaspora as part of that project is something to be commended for.
Yeah, and you anticipate my next question about Ujamaa. I'm curious, what do you think the inherent appeal from a Pan-Africanist perspective Ujamaa provided for the wider diaspora as a whole? Why is it something that seems to have an attraction to many of these figures who span across the diaspora?
So there are many points, I think, of appeal. for African Americans. I mean, of course, it does start with Nyerere. They saw him as somebody who was visionary, saw somebody who was ethical, principled. So that was sort of the first point of attraction. Whatever he's doing, since he's leader, you know, we should follow the developments in Tanzania. And you see that with the African American press, you see that with civil rights organizations, and then you see it intensify after, you know, Malcolm X visits there in 1964. So you had that, the fact that he spoke out against racism in the U.S., the fact that he was a proponent of ending apartheid in South Africa, which was an issue of importance to the diaspora as well. So these small sort of policies were very appealing. African-Americans who identified with Pan-Africanism, who identified with this idea of international kind of African unity, they saw some of his decisions as being a part of that. So not only allowing for liberation movements from Mozambique, South Africa, Angola, Namibia, not only allow them to set up military bases at, in Tanzania and to serve as a place of exile, but then also the efforts to unify mainland Tanganyika with Zanzibar to form the Union of Tanzania in 1964. That was also seen as a decision that Nyerere was somebody who was committed to Pan-Africanism and Pan-Africanism movement building. And then coming to your question, Ujamaa, you know, in 1967, when Nyerere kind of lays out his vision of Tanzania society as this social society based off of these kind of communal values that are very African, right? He's not borrowing from necessarily, you know, saying that we need to replicate European communism or socialism. Africans have this kind of communal ethic rooted in its culture. For African Americans who at the time were coming of age, there was this cultural revolution where they were beginning to look towards Africa and trying to find out about the African aspect of their identity. They're reading about Africa's ancient histories. They're, you know, reading about the African liberation movements and the leaders that were coming out of those movements. They were trying to identify with Africa on a political and cultural level. And here's Nyerere talking about, we have these African cultural values that are pre-colonial in nature. We need to go back to that. And for a group of people who were a minority in a racist capitalist society, having an economic system that exploited them for centuries, having this alternative sort of economic society presented to them that was African, quintessentially African, very appealing. Right. On a kind of cultural level and political level. And so, if you read Nyerere's writings on Ujamaa, not only the Arusha Declaration itself, which is really the policy document, but then his writings on Ujamaa in the books that he published leading up to its declaration in 1967, he doesn't talk about socialism strictly as an economic thing. He talks about it as a humanity thing. He talks about it as this as a society that's based on a set of humanistic principles. We shouldn't be exploiting each other, right, for money. And just breaking that down in the simplest way really spoke to some of the aspirations of African Americans who at the time were really trying to figure out different alternative societies that wasn't capitalistic, that wasn't racially hierarchical. And so Ujamaa kind of presented that model. That they embraced. You actually do see in Black America, for people that didn't necessarily travel and settle in Tanzania, you know, they're beginning to take on Kiswahili names. They're beginning to form cooperatives. So Ujamaa was being spread. You know, it was an idea that wasn't just seen as a policy idea, but something that was a broader ideology in itself that they thought could be useful in their struggles against racism on a global scale.
Indeed, and it's such a resounding characteristic of, you know, his time as president and really this decolonization period as a whole. And it's something that I think you give really good emphasis to, and at the same time cast it on this global scale. Speaking of sort of the intellectual ideas that are driving this period, intellectual discourse is kind of an important theme in your book. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the issues related to education or power publishing and how they shape the relationships between Black power and Tanzanian nationhood. I'm thinking specifically, you spend a good deal, a whole chapter talking about Walter Rodney's time at the University College of Dar es Salaam, or the successes and failures of certain publishers like Drummond Spear. Could you talk a little bit more about those?
Yeah, you know, again, I'm going to kind of go back to Malcolm X first, because he kind of lays down this platform or this agenda that African American activists and others could follow on you know, strategic approaches to alliance building with the Tanzanian government and party. And one of the things he kept harping on after he visits Tanzania, when he's in Tanzania, before he goes to Tanzania, when he's in Egypt, at the OAU conference, and then later when he returns to the United States and he's giving speeches throughout New York and Harlem, and telling people about his travels to Africa and to Tanzania specifically. And one of the things, and one of the consistent themes, is Malcolm X critiques the corporate media and government and the government and state controlled media as well. Because what he was able to see once he would touch the ground in Africa was that there was very limited resources as far as books, magazines, newspapers, journals, things that are being shared in a far more mass scale. And so Malcolm was trying to impress upon African Americans this need to build these alternative communication channels between African Americans and Africans, where they're speaking to each other without it being filtered by national major media outlets as well as the government. Because, you know, in doing research for this, you know, I was looking at USIS reports, which is the United States Information Services reports. And if you look at the reports from like 1960 to the mid 70s, I mean, they wouldn't touch the Black Power movement. It was very much about the moderate civil rights leadership, Dr. King, NAACP, Roy Wilkins. These are the people they're talking about as being the type of African-Americans that Tanzanians and Africans should be identifying with. And at the same time, they're criminalizing the more radical elements of the movement, the people like Malcolm X and organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So these people were getting a lot of misinformation. So that project was really important. The educational project of in the context of Drummond Spear Press, producing their own books, history, culture, about African diaspora and African history, politics, producing their own books, largely written by African and Black authors, and having a way to distribute it not only to Tanzanians, youth in particular in Kiswahili, but then also to African Americans as well. And their whole idea was saying that, look, we're up against centuries of again, characterization of African people and Black people in these very kind of racist constructions. So we have to tackle that. We've been told that we don't have a history. We've been told that African are savages. We have to create our own. We have to write our own material. We have to create our own knowledge and recover knowledge that's already been produced and have it circulated. You know, the Drummond Spear Press was not only producing books, they also set up a bookstore. And this was the place where you could find pretty much anything that alternative canon that was coming about in terms of African literature and diaspora literature, from novels to plays to history books to speeches and writings. So that's one thing, is the need to set up this transnational dialogue to share their histories and share their perspectives was really, really important. As far as what Walter Rodney was doing at the University of Dar es Salaam as an historian and lecturer in the history department, is you know, his set of classes that he was teaching, and I really appreciate the Walter Rodney Foundation for giving me access to kind of classified aspects of his collection. And part of that is kind of his curriculum, the courses that he was teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam, which really gave me insight in what he was trying to educate to largely African students. And I'm talking about not only Tanzanians, but the University of Dar es Salaam also brought students throughout East Africa and Africa writ large to study at what was really a kind of cutting edge on radical education at the highest level for like a 10 to 12 year period. So Walter Rodney, if you look at his syllabi, he's teaching courses on the history of transatlantic slave trade. He's teaching courses on the civil rights, Black Power movement. He's teaching courses on the Russian Revolution. And so he's kind of educating these young radical Tanzanians about Pan-Africanism, really about seeing the connections between resistance, not only in the Africa diaspora, Africa world, but also in the European world as well, and seeing these connections and leak to inform them about what they were doing outside of the classroom at the University of Dar es Salaam with the formation of the University Students African Revolutionary Front. So education are like two major themes, but approaching it from, like you said, the angle of book publishing and circulation, as well as the angle of higher education and teaching.
Yeah, and it's as I was reading through those sections, I could only imagine what it would have been like sitting in that classroom with Walter Rodney lecturing you. It must have been an amazing experience for those students as a whole.
Yeah, no, they were. I was reading through, you know, as someone who was really creating a kind of cadre of African historians, you know, that's really what Rodney was doing. Rodney was somebody who really understood the situation that he was in. He was like, my role is to be this professor, this educator, and to try to educate students to not only leave with technical skills, but also leaving it with a kind of anti-imperialist sort of worldview and Pan-Africanist worldview. But he, you know, I was looking over his letters and looking over his curriculum, and he was somebody who was, you know, traveling to see his PhD students doing field research and doing these check-ins and updates. You know, he was someone who was very hands-on with that mentorship. But then the other sort of quality that Rodney brought to the table, he was very young. Again, he produced, you know, his major book, How Europe Undeveloped Africa, before he turned 30. And he was very young. And so a lot of even the graduate students and students were not that far in age. And so they really were able to build a friendship, you know, with How Europe Undeveloped Africa. I mean, his major reviewers were two students, two Tanzanians. He would give them the first copies of the manuscript. So here's somebody who really took seriously his role as a mentor, as well as teaching students the kind of his version of history, which was a very kind of Marxist, you know, unorthodox approach to studying history.
And indeed. So you conclude your book with a section entitled Undoing, where you discuss the successes and failures of the Sixth Pan-African Congress. And if you'd like, I'd love to go a bit more in detail about what you see as the major successes and failures of this Pan-African Congress.
Well, I mean, first starting from a kind of grassroots level, you know, I really feel like the Sixth Pan-African Conference of 1974, which brought independent African nations, representatives from independent African nations, represented from non-governmental organizations together for a week at the University of Dar es Salaam to talk about the future of Pan-Africanism, about unity, about decolonization, you know. So to organize a global conference on that scale, it was so many actors involved that I really feel like this Sixth Pan-African Conference is a book in itself. So for me, I approached it really from the major organizers of it, who were a bunch of African diaspora peoples from United States mostly, who were part of what was called the International kind of Steering Committee. They were the ones that were doing the major organizing for this work. These were young people, again, a lot of them hadn't even turned 30 yet, and they were organizing an international conference. So one of the successes is the kind of development and experience that they got out of that, the political experience they got out of that. They traveled all over the place. They met with African liberation leaders, presidents, heads of state, and they really kind of put together something that ended up taking place and really being an opportunity to really hash out ideological differences. And depending on where you're approaching it, from what angle, it was a success for some and it was a really bitter, bitter disappointment for many. Yes. So one, leadership development on the ground, you know, the kind of mentorship they got from heads of state, from people like C.L.R. James from Trinidad, a longtime activist in the Pan-Africanism movement. So that was one success. I do think that the fact that they got all these people together to really incorporate African-Americans into what was really a state-centered project by the time, with Pan-Africanism after 1945 and the emergence of these independent states, they really took hold of the Pan-African movement and really made it a more continental-based movement, meaning that the question of how do we incorporate the diaspora really got put to the wayside in a lot of ways. And they're really talking about what states and governments can do regionally and continentally in decades to come. And so African-Americans were in the diaspora, were trying to carve out, well, where do we stand? Can we be involved in this conversation? And they were able to participate in this conversation officially as a delegation. So that's, I think, a big success, because what we see later with what became the African Union, formerly known as the Organization of African Unity, is that they do have a diaspora component in how they're talking about Pan-Africanism. It's not just reduced to the continent and nation states. So they really brought that conversation. They didn't let that conversation die. I think the other thing that was important was that from a diaspora point of view, I think the conference really solidified this position they had on U.S. imperialism. I think that was one of the biggest messages that they wanted to get across to African governments, starting with Malcolm X and then later on. We have lived in U.S. empire. We have experienced racism. We need to really highlight and unpack the sort of racist undertones of its foreign and domestic policy, of its foreign and economic policies towards Africa when talking about the U.S. And they really pressed that point, and it really got on the agenda. And if you look at the resolutions, you do see that form of consciousness among African governments and being wary of U.S. empire. So I think it's great that that was put on the, was able to remain on the agenda. And then I think, you know, some other smaller sort of successes at that conference was just the experience of the non-organizers who went there, who had never been to an international gathering of that kind, who were introduced to the kind of structures of those events. And then we're able to kind of take that home to the United States and kind of educate other activists as well as the community on a larger scale about what's happening in Africa. Because I think what happens after, especially Six Pan-African Conference in 74, you have, you know, the independence of Mozambique in 75 and Angola, but then the Pan-African movement shifts from this focus on the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. And you really look at the Six Pan-African Conference as putting that again on the agenda as a primary concern. And African-Americans played this contributory role to the end of apartheid in South Africa by getting involved with the divestment campaigns, by raising awareness in the United States, by advocating for it through boycotts as well as legislative policies. And so I think that was also a kind of more indirect outgrowth of the conference.
Yes, and it's true. And I think you do not definitely, I think, emphasize it really well for that. And building upon that, you end the book discussing legacy, and beyond the scope of this 64 to 74 time frame that you've created, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your feelings on the long-term legacy of this period of Pan-Africanism. I know you've touched on it for a little bit, but do you think there are some underlying legacies that we really need to appreciate for this particular period?
Yeah, you know, when writing this book, I think, you know, primary audience, you know, besides it being a kind of academic audience, but, you know, I come out of kind of movement building, working with young people in a Pan-Africanism context here in the U.S. and places like East Africa. And so I was kind of writing to activist movement builders of today as well. And I feel like the big lesson out of that is, you know, especially when thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement, which has a lot of potential potential to be international, but is not necessarily pursuing the international agenda as strongly as what we see in the past. And hopefully this book kind of says that there are these avenues and ways to approach international solidarity. So that's one legacy that remains and still there. In my conclusion, I kind of moved to looking at the memory, like you said, the legacy. How is it being memorialized? How is this era being memorialized today? And so I didn't really want to go into talking about, you know, kind of the regional kind of state-led Pan-Africanism that we see today, where we don't necessarily see the kind of relationships being built with more kind of progressive organizations in the diaspora, but really something that's driven by the state, a lot of NGO stuff that's, and we can get into the whole critique with NGOs in Africa and to what extent they're doing work as well as just contributing to the problem. But we don't see that kind of collaboration anymore. But where we do see it being talked about, where we do see it as this sort of moment of inspiration, of resistance, is in kind of cultural movements. And we see that with hip-hop is the biggest sort of cultural phenomenon for young people across the globe. I mean, millions and millions of young people are embracing hip-hop culture and music, using it as a tool of education, empowerment, resistance to their forms of oppression. And so in Tanzania, after socialism, mid-1980s, we see hip hop culture emerge, and particularly with rap music. And you see a set of artists who are beginning to look back at the Ujamaa era, who are beginning to educate a new generation, a younger generation, about what happened in the past. And they're looking back at the Ujamaa era with nostalgia, but they're also looking back at it to critique their present, to critique Tanzania's move to neoliberalism, to critique globalization and how it's led to incredible amounts of unemployment for young people. And so they're the ones that are talking about Nyerere. They're the ones that are talking about, hey, Malcolm X came here in Tanzania. They're the ones that are making references to the Panthers. And so they're kind of serving as these historians in a way for a completely new audience. So that legacy remains in the context, I think, of a culture movement more than anything. We don't necessarily see, at least to my knowledge, again, there's a lot happening with hip hop continentally, with Africans trying to connect with each other. There's a lot happening in the global hip hop movement where people from all across the African continent, from Latin America, Asia, Europe, are trying to connect and create this larger kind of political platform or agenda about hip hop, how hip hop can unite and how hip hop can be a force of radical change. And you do see that with Tanzanian young people are connecting with people in Kenya, South Africa, Senegal. So hip hop holds that potential for a new form of 21st century Pan-Africanism, if you will. But I don't think we're going to replicate what was happening during what I'm talking about. I just think the lesson is that, you know, if you're going to work with governments, you know, you're going to probably have to give up a lot. You're going to have to give up a lot of autonomy. You're going to have to deal with a set of challenges and obstacles when working with the state. And so that was something that was explored. And we see these conclusions of these projects not necessarily working out. So it might signal this shift towards a more transnational kind of grassroots type of organizing that we're seeing, but there's so much more that can happen with it.
Yeah, all of these are great questions and thoughts that the reader is left with when they finish with the book. Well, Seth, we've taken up a good deal of your time, but before we go, I was curious if you could tell us a bit about what you're working on now and what we could look forward to seeing from you in the near future.
This is going to be pretty short because I just told you, you know, I looked at this book as kind of part one to a larger story about how diaspora and Tanzania interact. And so really the second part of this book is looking at a diaspora made culture, hip hop, and how it's traveled to Tanzania and how it's been appropriated by Tanzanian young people and used as this tool of resistance, of identity formation. So it's really looking at urban youth cultures through this hip hop lens. And that's part two. So it's really a history of Tanzanian hip hop, taking it all the way back to its origins in the mid 80s and then kind of following it through to the present. But I'm not necessarily approaching this project as a book. It's really something that's going to be more in the realm of digital humanities, a very interactive, multimodal kind of presentation, just because I think hip hop is so visual. Of a culture that to kind of capture it just in text form may not do complete justice to the project. So I'm collaborating with a professor at Howard University in Washington, D.C. We're trying to do a 3-year project that looks at gender and language in hip hop in Tanzania and South Africa, and doing this through a series of documentary short films. So we're collaborating with some filmmakers in Tanzania and South Africa and the United States, and we're kind of serving as these not only consultants, really producing of this project that really looks at not only women's participation in hip hop, the ways in which they work within a very male-dominated space, but also a comparative look at two completely different movements at different stages of development presently. Because I do think we really feel like young people, youth, you know, this question of African youth and where they're at and where they're going is a question that I think is really has really got scholars and researchers interested in, because they represent, you know, in a lot of African countries, majority of the population, they're the most vulnerable to things like crime and child soldier issues. And so it's just a big we just hope that we can look at hip hop and show that we don't necessarily have to look at hip hop as a political movement, as a Pan-Africanism movement, but really try to appreciate it as an alternative form of cultural expression where youth are really trying to tell us something about their marginality, their oppression, their dreams about the future and about the future of Africa.
That sounds like a fantastic project, actually. And I think I can speak for myself, and hopefully I can speak for the audience, saying we're all really looking forward to seeing that come together, and both reading, listening, and seeing it as it fully forms over the next as long as it takes. But yes, that's absolutely fantastic. All right, well, Seth, thank you very much for this conversation. This has been a wonderful talk overall. We really appreciate your time.
All right, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Take care.